The next stop, Sprawlcast.
You're listening to Sprawlcast. My name is Jeremy Clausus, and I'm the founder and editor of The Sprawl. And Sprawlcast is made in collaboration with CJSW 90.9 FM in Calgary. And we are podcasting on Treaty 7 land. This is the traditional territory of the Blackfoot Confederacy, the Tsuut'ina Nation, Stoney Nakoda Nation, and this place is also home to Métis Nation of Alberta Region 3.
My friends, it is time for an election.
All right, that was Rachel Notley speaking in Calgary, and the election is happening on April 16th. Alberta politics have been a wild ride over the last few days, even more so than usual. And I don't want to get too much into the what of what's happening, because there are new revelations coming out every day about the legitimacy of Jason Kenney's leadership of the UCP, the United Conservative Party. So that's a very rapidly evolving story. But what I want to get into is the why of what's happening, and the why of what we're seeing in Alberta politics right now. Dr. Melanie Thomas is a political science professor at the University of Calgary, and she has a theory when it comes to Alberta politics about what we're seeing. And it's a concept called loser's consent. Now, I met up with Melanie in East Village right after Rachel Notley's announcement, and I'll let her explain the concept. Oh, and just a technical note, I did this interview outside. It was too nice outside to do any kind of interviews inside, so we met outside.
So the concept that I keep coming back to about Alberta politics, especially since the 2015 provincial election, is this idea of loser's consent. This is a book that was published by Christopher Anderson and a bunch of his colleagues back with Oxford University Press. I think the publication date is 1999, so it's a bit old. But one of the things that they're looking at is this idea about democracy is one of these only contexts where a lot of people lose outcomes for, like, contests for power. So if you think about an election, this is about we vote to decide who we want to give seats to. If you get enough seats, you get to literally control the levers of power, especially with a majority government situation for the at least 4 years. Constitutionally, it's 5 years, but... So, and if you think about it, one of the refrains that consistently comes up is that you don't need a majority of support to be able to do this in our system, and this is pretty common around the democratic world. So that means that the majority of people who are participating are losers in that they don't get their preference. Like, this is not an existential loser kind of thing. It really is like my preference isn't actually the what gets to control the levers of power. And so you can see how very quickly this could lead to disaffection with government. And where people were concerned about this first, which is why you see the publication date of this stuff coming in the 90s, is in transitioning from a post-Soviet context into a new democracy in that context, where once you kind of open things up, then people will, like, play the electoral game, and then they have this iteration where they've lost, and they were like, so why should I trust this system? Why should I care about, why should I lend this system legitimacy? And so in that context, it kind of makes sense. What ends up happening with loser's consent is that you need losers to consent to continue to participate in the democratic system. So they need to agree, losers need to consent to be governed by the side that they don't want in government, and they also have to consent to play again in terms of actually going for elections.
Now, Melanie does this crazy thing. She reads the comments under news stories. And she's actually gleaned some insights from what she's found there. She hasn't just dismissed it. As she read the comments after the NDP was elected in 2015, she noticed that many people were not treating the outcome of the election as legitimate. They were saying, call another election right away. Then in 2016, there was the whole coup d'etat situation. And if you remember that, it was basically a small populist effort to remove Notley from power. And when this happened, people made fun of it, especially on the progressive side. It was funny, they misspelled coup d'etat, and there was a tendency to be dismissive of what was happening. But Melanie saw something worrisome at play.
If you're looking at something like the contention around how that UCP leadership contest happened, one of the questions I think is worth asking, especially for people who have been observing, say, federal politics for quite some time, Jason Kenney, who was a considerably more serious political operator than Brian Jean. If you put Jason Kenney's political CV next to Brian Jean's political CV, one of them is more competent than the other one, and that is Jason Kenney. I think that's a pretty objective statement.
In terms of politics.
In terms of politics. Yeah. And so the question then comes, why would you even entertain the idea of something like a kamikaze campaign for a candidate that you're likely to beat anyway? Like, why take that risk? Particularly, why take that risk if somebody's prepared to throw illegal money at the issue? Like, that's the one where I'm looking at this being like, why would you do that? This doesn't make sense. You could have won in a campaign where it was just straight up you guys. Like, and so I keep coming back to this idea of loser's consent, where it's this idea of this idea of people objecting to the outcomes because they just don't like them so much that they are prepared to say, if it's not the way that I want it, it is illegitimate, which is a real, if you put that into a context of democracy as we iterate this process of losers give consent to be governed because they see the process as legitimate and they consent to play again because they see the process as legitimate. Phrased that way, Alberta's got a real problem with democratic malaise and a real problem with democratic norms.
And so, correct me if I'm interpreting this correctly or not, but we're kind of seeing this play out on two levels, if I understand what you're saying. Number one is the 2015 election, kind of the deep discontent that still existed after that, but also you're seeing it play out within a specific party, the UCP.
So I would say you see it on two levels. One is with exactly that. There's a small but pretty loud constituency that never gave their consent to the process because they saw an outcome that they didn't like on the electorate side of things. And I think it was foolish to easily mock them. This is the coup d'etat stuff. This is the people who say, and I think you can even still see it now where people say, call the election. I'm only prepared to play this one more time because I think that I will get the outcome I want the next time that we have the election now. So you can kind of see it coming around in a number of different ways. And then there's this, what's happening at the elite level. And to me, I find the reaction at the elite level to be the more dangerous of the two, I think. I would expect a great deal of diversity amongst voters, but I also expect voters to kind of tune out from politics in between elections. All the research shows that that happens consistently. And so that I kind of think makes it pose less of a threat to democratic norm is when elites are prepared to say that they're going to trade on some of this stuff for short-term gain because the short-term gain is I need to see my side in power because I think it's illegitimate otherwise. And I'm not saying that everybody who's organizing around, say, the United Conservative Party, like I'm not saying that this is their motivation. It's just that I see enough that could be interpreted through that lens that it makes me very nervous about what we're seeing.
I want to jump back to something you said earlier about the coup d'etat stuff.
Right.
Because when that was happening, a lot of people, especially on the progressive side, you know, thought that was a joke, mocked the whole thing. But you're saying that, you know, that's not something for mockery.
I mean, I did see a lot of elitism in the mockery, not knowing how to spell coup d'etat and just calling it, you know, the kind of like bastardized English version of that. It was easy to mock, and I think in going for those reactions first, because I remember my initial reaction was, what is going on? This is, what? Like, this is just one of these things where we're just kind of like, oh, wow. It was easy to dismiss that, and it was easy to mock it, but the argument that I want to make is that there is a core of a democratic norm that's in that, or there's a core commentary on how that particular constituency saw democratic norms that should concern us. The core concern that I had was that these were people who were fully prepared to say that they didn't get the outcome that they wanted in an election, therefore they thought the electoral process was illegitimate. So they're not talking about the administration of the election. They're not talking about election fraud. They're not talking about something going wrong with Elections Alberta or somebody actually breaking the law to win the election. They're just saying, I didn't like the outcome, therefore the outcome is illegitimate. And this is persisted. And so what I see now, this is why I read the comments, is when I read a comment that said people were so keen to change the government back to a conservative party that they would be content if Jason Kenney was governing from jail. So this popped up on 770 News. So it was a radio broadcaster saying, wait a minute, this seems like it's pretty far out there. But you can see this in, and this is where party identification as a concept comes in as well, where people who are partisans, which is totally fine. I'm not making a normative statement about that. But partisanship, the way that I see it most usefully, is that it acts as a lens through which people will filter political information. And so it helps direct where people place emphasis and where people try to de-emphasize stuff. And so I see people saying, all of this stuff that I'm hearing coming out that is problematic for my party, I'm going to discount that because for me it doesn't matter. Where this gets into the loser's consent side of things is that if it's about policy, like everybody does this kind of around the partisan spectrum, but when it's about things like they're making credible claims about fraud in, say, in a leadership contest, I don't care because I want a certain outcome. It's that I don't care because I want a certain outcome about a question of fraud, about a question of democratic legitimacy and democratic process that makes me nervous, because it's very clear that the thing that motivates is the outcome and not actually the democratic process. It says that norm that should be kind of like the centralizing focus for everybody is just not there and robustly like it needs to be.
Yeah, I mean, the same is true of journalism, what you describe in terms of partisans filtering information. Like, if I see an article and it doesn't jive with kind of my partisan lens, then that's not journalism, or it's fake news, or I discount it.
And so I see that in comments as well, where if it's a story that is negative about a party, you see partisans actually come up and the comment is fake news. And this is the transport from the United States and this is the thing. We always knew that partisans would discount news that was bad for their party and overemphasize news that was good. All partisans do this. We kind of expect this to be that case. Where, again, the democratic norm becomes a problem is that democracies only work with a free and fair and open press and open media. And so the idea that people are prepared to say that the media is not open because they're not saying what I like based on my lens, this is where, like, so you can see that there are multiple democratic norms that are at risk here.
I spoke with Melanie about one more thing. And that's intellectual honesty.
It's hard to ask people to be open-minded. But when we talk about open-minded, and when I teach the elections class, this is one of the things where I really want to instill into my students. Open-mindedness isn't about blindly accepting all information. Open-mindedness is simply being open to the idea that evidence could exist that might change your mind about an issue. And so if you've got a context where you prefer a party and you want to give more weight to information that's positive about your party and discount stuff that's negative, I would say that people will continue to do this. And so I'm not going to ask them not to do that, because that's what folk do. What I would ask is to just sit and consider, like, think about, like, what would you need to see to actually change your mind about something? And then I think this is a useful exercise for everybody. Like, what would I need to see for me? Just because I have policy preferences. So, like, what would I need to see for me to think that a preference I previously held is no longer a good idea? And even just thinking about, like, is there information that exists that could actually move me off of that? At least knowing thyself in that kind of context is, I think, a useful exercise. And so this is the sort of thing where it's like, if you're a partisan and you really like your party, ask yourself, is there what would move you from saying, I don't think I like that anymore? Because that's the concept of party ID. That's what it's supposed to do. It was brought up by people who said that they were Democrats, but they were voting for Dwight Eisenhower on the Republican ticket for president. And so the paradox about partisanship is you like a party and you identify with that party, but you're voting for somebody else. That's what makes partisanship really interesting. That's what motivated the whole body of scholarship to begin with. And I feel as though that's been distorted by academics who haven't read the original literature, but also because of that distortion, this idea that if I identify with a party, I automatically have to vote for them and I have to endorse everything that they do. And that's not the case. And I think some of the most powerful, like, accountability checks will be from members of a political party. Like, so, activists who are actually there and watching stuff happening and being kind of like, hey, wait a minute, no, And this is the thing. Every person who's a party elite who's actually tried to, like, say, do government, will say that party members become, like, an epic pain in the ass when it comes to actually getting some stuff done.
Yeah.
Precisely because they're the ones that are right there being like, wait a minute, we have principles here. Like, how does this match with our principles? And so I would encourage party members to continue to be the pain in the ass that they can be, because this actually helps keep the whole process honest, I think.
So, in other words, intellectual honesty, that's mm-hmm. what you're calling for. Like, if you ask that question, what would actually change my mind?
Yeah.
You're setting a certain bar for yourself in terms of intellectual honesty with yourself.
Yeah, so questions I think that are relevant to, like, Alberta politics right now. If you say that allegations of corruption aren't your issue, what do you need to see to make you take a look at that? Most people will say that they're concerned about the economy. And I mean, so my colleague Trevor Toome at the University of Calgary, I think one way to phrase the way that he's been talking about a lot of economic data is to say, what do you need to see to be persuaded that the economy is maybe not as bad as what you think it is? Or what would you need to see to say that the recovery is not happening the way that you would like to hope that it is, right? This cuts across both ways. On these issues, other things, what would you need to see about the environment that would make you, like, take that as seriously as an issue as some other ones, right? What would you need to see to say, I'm going to start looking at other issues other than the basket that I care about? What would you need to see to say this issue that I thought was previously irrelevant now is actually becoming really relevant again?
Definitely. Yeah, that's a useful exercise for everybody on all sides, for sure. All right. Well, thanks very much for your time, Melanie.
No, thank you.
End of line. Thanks for listening and see you again soon.
You've been listening to Sprawlcast. This is actually the beginning of the 8th edition of The Sprawl, so our election coverage kicks off with this podcast, and we're going to be covering the election for the next month, so check us out online at www.sprawlcalgary.com. Follow us on social media. We're at Sprawl Calgary on Facebook, Twitter, and Instagram. And hey, now's a good time to sign up as a Sprawl member, because if you do, we will send you our freshly printed newspaper that we just made. We just finished the last edition of The Sprawl. I was kind of counting on more of a break in between that one and this one, but here we are. So sign up as a member of The Sprawl and you'll get a copy of that limited run newspaper. Our theme music is by Dan D. Augustino and Kenny Murdoch. Our C-Train narrator is Holly McConnell. Thanks for listening and stay tuned for more election coverage.